question and answer segment of the program. What we're going to ask people to do, if they have questions, please raise your hand.
Thank you. Mr. Churchill?
Sir.
Actually a graduate of Columbia College, I was glad to see you mention it. I appreciate that. In the very beginning, you stated that you were riveted by the fall of the World Trade Center. And it reminded me, it brought me back to that day. I actually was in Brooklyn. I heard the first plane hit. I went outside. I saw the second plane hit. And my first thought was about my brother-in-law, Rich Frazier, who was on the 92nd floor of two World Trade Center working for Aon Insurance Company. Aon Insurance lost 200 people that day. You may be aware of reinsurance. Reinsurance, they manage risk for other insurance companies so they can pay for construction at New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina, things like that. That's what he did. So I biked over to my sister. She's 27 years old. She had a sick kid. I got to her apartment in Peter Cooper Village, a small apartment they lived in, just when the trade centers fell. And then I spent the rest of the day with my sister waiting for Rich to come home. Okay. Well, I just had a different reaction. My idea wasn't to run to the computer and think about U.S. policy. My idea was to hope that some people would come home that day. But I have just a very brief question. There's a lot I could have asked, but I'll ask it. The title of your lecture is The Fabrication of Innocent Americans. A wise man once said to me that all research is me research, and you actually alluded to that. Given that your ancestry has been extensively researched, members of your family have been DNA tested, and it has been proven that you are 100% white and the direct descendant of Georgia slave owner Richard Tyner. How do you explain the self-loathing that motivates you to masquerade as an Indian and lie to gullible undergraduates? I'm sure there's an article I have.
Do we have a second question? Or Churchill, would you like to?
Sure. I've been researched extensively by a New Jersey State police officer who took up genealogy as a hobby based on white records that were extended back through time to a point beyond which they couldn't go. There's no indication that my family is not exactly who my family says it is. And there's no little jerk from Columbia gonna overrule my grandmother or the rule of that I am. One other point, however. As to your DNA testing, which cannot do what they say it does, I will not subscribe to the notion that Western science always and inevitably trumps oral history or native traditions either. And you, with your preoccupation with race as definitive a state of mind and culture, need to get your ass back in your clan ropes where you belong. Thank you.
Do we have another question?
Yeah.
We need to make sure everyone gets a chance to speak. So we have another question to come.
Given this very grim view of U.S. history, and given the grim view of the United States today, I know there's positive things happening in Latin America that are really encouraging. But could you identify some of the positive and encouraging things that are happening in the United States today?
Yeah, I could. One of them is the reconstitution of Students for a Democratic Society, which happened over the last summer, okay? And there may be people in here don't know what that means, but that was probably the most potent for my white brother fixated with this, okay?
Thank
you, brother. You're quite welcome. Okay, the most potent white alternative or radical or dissident or whatever term you'd like to apply to it, organization of the 1960s, based on the notion of essentially an anarchist model, town hall meeting model, participatory democracy. Very potent, very important, although it's not coming out as a white organization this time. So that's one. Reconstitution of the Black Panther Party in a forum. And the Black Panther Party. I was about, I don't know, I lose a little track of time doing things like this, but somewhere within the last 6 months in San Jose, California, where security was provided by a reconstituted Brown Berets. So what you see is connections being made between current generation of activists who are not content with the status quo and are looking around for ways to challenge it, to sort of hook back continuity with organizations that offered promise that was aborted in a lot of ways a generation ago. In that continuity, you see the promise of a resistance which isn't just resistance, but actually the mechanism of change coming back, at least potentially into view. And I find that very encouraging. I also find it encouraging that you got a lot of people of all sorts of persuasions who are increasingly unwilling to back up. We can compromise. We can always compromise and get out of a tight spot. Well, when you're compromising a compromise that has already been compromised twice, you really don't have much less to compromise with other than just roll over, present yourself in a subjugation or self-subjugating position and take that to be your natural lot in life. So you've got everyone from Black Bloc anarchists to every mother for peace out there who is showing a different temper. No, we're not going to compromise on things which are unequivocally true or correct. You're simply going to accept it for what it is. That attitude, again, and that's been missing for a very long time while people went shopping for new rap beats or new fashion designs or new diets or building better bike paths or doing anything other than come to grips with the core issues that confront us. And the tension is going back to the core now. That's consciousness, actually the most promising sign I see. And people realizing that there is a third world out there other than that they make statements of solidarity with, that they can actually draw lessons and examples and inspiration from. And that's a change, too. Think about it. Two generations now, people have been in solidarity with every kind of liberation movement the world had to offer except one right here. Yeah, well, right here is where it counts, because this here is the belly of the beast. Okay? But the really important part is who my grandma was. Okay? Really, really important part is who my grandma was. Not world peace, trade inequity, starvation, nature of the political zeitgeist. The really important question is who my grandma was. You absolute unadulterated jerk.
When we resist, should we use violence or continue using nonviolence?
Oh. That was an interesting formulation. In this hand I'm holding, and in this hand I'm... These aren't things. I'm trying to wrap my mind around how you think in this context you can be nonviolent. All right? The closest I can come in conceptualizing this is you acquiesce in systemic massive violence continuously without doing anything effectual to stop it. And I don't see how that's nonviolent. Okay? Violence is a continuous tone. That's supposed to be what you're in opposition to. And maybe you got an idea how to bring that to a stop. Okay? If you snap your fingers three times with just that rhythm, the whole system's going to come screeching to a halt and drop to its knees. I'm being facetious. Okay? So you tried that and it didn't work. What's next? You buy this different t-shirt from a different political organization down the block and you wear it nonstop until it rots out in the armpits. Okay? But that didn't stop it either. And you bought three different flavors of incense to burn as you did your next candle lit bit. All right? I can keep ticking them off. As you try them and they don't work, you have to move. Sooner or later, you're going to run out of excuses to dodge being uncomfortable yourself and get into something where you actually start to come to grips with the fact that power maintains itself through force of arms. That's why cops are armed. There's several here. Ask them. Okay? Now, tonight, nominally, they're on my side. Tomorrow night they won't be. There you have it. But that's the whole point of it. It's not to serve and protect so much as it is to maintain order. That's the job. And if the order is unjust, we see where this goes. Yeah. Singing Kumbaya is just not going to overcome a 357 Magnum. If you actually were able to sing in a timbre that threatened the stability of the system, they would shoot you. All right? Real simple. So if you want to affect change, maybe you ought to start first figuring out the rudimentary things of what would go into that and how you stay alive while you're doing it. Of course, it is always possible to turn it into a sort of a ritual form and a spectator sport so that you get permits and you stand where you're assigned and you do only what you're told and allowed to do in the expectation, no doubt, that that's going to cause terror in the hearts of those in authority. Then go home and watch yourself at 6 o'clock news. And that's the bulk of the so-called opposition movement over the last 30 years. Yeah.
Do you have another question? In the back... with the brown coat.
Yeah.
Please stand up and speak clearly.
Ward, I was wondering, your essay came out shortly after 9/11. The right-wing attack came out a couple of years later. Why the wait, do you think?
I couldn't answer that one, but maybe if you went to BillO'Reilly.com, because that's who really basically surfaced it, although... You got several organizations who may have been hoarding them. Yeah, it came out shortly after is an understatement. It came out on the 12th of September. I wrote it on the 11th in the afternoon. Okay? And I did so because I'm kind of concerned with the well-being of people beyond my immediate family and circle of friends. Like, they count too, and you got these massive numbers. So when I was asked to write it, I wrote from the gut on that basis of being concerned with a little more than self. And so it was available on the 12th. And the only response I got initially, this is kind of interesting to me, were from self-styled Marxists in New York City. And there was a flurry, about 30 or 40. And they all purported to be Marxists, and they all purported to have a relative in the trade center, and all of their relatives were recently immigrated manual laborers or workers, custodial staff, food workers. In fact, I found out that there were more recently immigrated custodial, food service, and other such workers in the trade center than the total number of people killed, and that every one of these
was related to a Marxist
in New York. Which is bizarre. And then I got some little guy from the right wing. One. During that first, 10-day period when I was getting responses to it, right winger, who said, "How dare you say these people weren't innocent?" And I said, "How dare you ask me that question? Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson just said the same thing for different reasons. Why don't you get in their case?" And he had the good graces to write back. One sentence says, "You're right, I will." Never heard from him again. So I assume he wrote to Pat and Jerry. Funny, I don't ever hear anything about that anymore from the right wing. So I guess they really do mean all you have to do, no matter what you do, is just say, "I'm sorry." What was that, Allie something or other movie from the 1960s, "Love Means Never Having to Say You're Sorry"? And on the right now, all you have to do, if you're a mass murderer, is say you are. And it's cool as long as you're one of our mass murderers. Oh, well.
The young woman in the blue.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth. I'm
with
the Spartacus Youth Club, which is a Marxist organization.
I know Sparks.
Yeah, so we came out in defense of you against this right-wing witch hunt, which seized on the exposures that you've done of the COINTELPRO U.S. and careless crimes around the world and genocide of Native peoples here in the U.S. We do have a difference with you. We think that human liberation is a material act which requires the revolutionary mobilization of the working class.
Do you have a question, ma'am?
Yes, I do.
Can you please hurry up and get to the question?
I don't want to ask it, so we can cut chase on that.
All right, so my point is that any illusions that the working class can have a common interest with the capitalists, or that the state machinery of repression, the cops, the courts, the prisons, the army, can be used in the interest of workers or the oppressed are really deadly, right? The attack on the World Trade Center was a criminal attack that killed working people. It's not the same as the Pentagon, which is an institution of U.S. imperialist military.
What's the question?
Right. So my question is, how can you... Look, only the revolutionary mobilization of the working class based on an understanding of its social power and the need for its independence can actually change the material basis for the oppression in society. So I want to know, what is your program that you counterpose to that?
What was the question?
What is your
very end, without all the prelude, just what's the question?
What is your political program that you can't oppose to that?
What's my political program that I can oppose to that? Holding people accountable, beginning with themselves, for their actions. All right? Magic word worker doesn't absolve anyone of anything. By and large, the Ku Klux Klan was composed of workers. I do not exonerate them from lynching by virtue of their class status, all right? Simple as that.
The gentleman in the brown, right here.
Thank you. Could you speak a little bit on what would be like a legitimate claim to land? Like not in the sense of just the claim as in manifest destiny, but like, for example, a basis for how we could redress indigenous peoples, such like in the United States or in Palestine.
Interesting formulation there, United States or in Palestine, okay? These are not quite interchangeable, although they certainly do have some commonalities. I can tell you a place to start, and then I can tell you two places to go from there. And that's not the end game program, but it'd take longer than you got available to work on it. So you've got plenty to fill your plate here with what I'm going to hand you. Okay, you can start with, well, in Kappler, there's the text of 371 ratified treaties between the federal government and the United States, which is all by and for the people, remember? Okay? In this case, it really is, because y'all, in a generic sense, are in possession of the property that's transferred. Okay, 371 ratified treaties, most of which have to do with land cessions, one form or another. Vine Deloria and Ray DeMalley came up with several more, so you got an even 400. You start with the text of the treaties themselves and look at the disposition of property that's delineated therein. What you're going to find is that there's about 35% of the 48 contiguous states that was not, this is the legal basis for a land transfer between prior owner and owner in international terms. There's about 35% of the 48 contiguous states that is not covered by any treaty. The United States just went in and took it. Now, I can quote H.W. Bush on that one, okay? That's an illegal occupation. Just war requires that all due force be used to. But there might be another way of doing it. Like, oh, I don't know, try obeying the law. Right? So, first slogans for law enforcement, these are the major laws in the land. Sixth article of the U.S. Constitution acknowledges that, supreme law of the land. So those areas in the United States, that roughly one-third, are not covered by treaty, remain, legally speaking, the property of the indigenous nations who owned them. Now turn to Vienna Convention, law of treaties. What you find is a treaty that is coerced or fraudulent is invalid. The same real estate documents at issue here. So there's a good chunk of that nominally transferred land which was never legally transferred because they did things like go in and cut off the rations to the Lakotas in 1877 to force consent to the alienation of the Black Hills. That's not a legitimate land transfer. That's still Lakota property by law. And that's U.S. law along with indigenous law. I talk in those terms because that's usually terms American citizens understand. But on points that I'm making, we got confluence of agreement. And it is also consonant with international law. So all the law that could be brought to bear here agrees on this point. Okay?
I'm going to take just a couple more questions.
Once you're done with the fraudulent and coerced treaties, well, y'all going to be happy to hear the Crown of England did, in fact, acquire legal title to Manhattan Island so y'all can stay. Okay? You got 13 colonies, which is all the land that was ever actually transferred to the Continental Congress by Crown of England because that was all the land they actually owned. They had acquisition rights to the rest of the land over as far as the Mississippi.
So you got to go to the treaty record of the United States at that point. You got 13 colonies, and then you've got whatever treaties you can find as being valid and therefore binding. Okay? That's how you get an understanding on it. Then you become a good Republican, I suppose. Okay, and start screaming about law enforcement, law enforcement, law enforcement. But you mean actual laws, important ones, the constitutional level ones, like the treaties. Okay? Very least, you won't let those clowns talk about no smoking ordinance and stuff being law. Okay? While they're flagrantly violating the consequential laws, as they do every day in the name of law enforcement. See? It goes to clarity. Did this help you at all?
Well, I guess I'm more interested in whether since...
No, you're not interested in the law. You would like something more cosmic?
No, I'm interested in the law, but I'm thinking if you're seeking terms of redress for indigenous peoples, do you want to hold them to their own legal hypocrisy, or do you think there's another another way to...
Look, my ancestors signed those treaties. I'll abide by them. All right? That's the lens of bilateral communication that was made. I mean, somewhere in my gut, I'd like to say we need economic development in terms of establishment of manufacturing plants for water wings. You all start swimming. Well, the technological, okay, that's idiotic. Ain't going to happen. But how about this law common denominator thing? It's not going to be some crystal ball. I don't get to take acid and decide what is right. We've got an actual record of it. That your ancestors, my ancestors, and everybody else's ancestors, to one way or another in this room, concurred in. They did it fraudulently in some cases, they did it coercively in some cases, but you nonetheless got a concrete record and you start there. When you get to the point where that's acknowledged, that this has a validity, then you can start working out these other things. But you've got to have some firm ground to stand on. That's it. Okay?
I'm interested in your idea, the phrase you said, the planes having souls on the wings, wraiths on the wings, the kind of necessary endemic of the system. Watch your stuff.
There's a little drop here that I've tried to drop all the time. I apologize for that.
All right. And I'm assuming that you would put the USS Cole bombings and embassies in Africa on the same level as the 9/11 train towers. And I was wondering where you would put Beslan, or if you had... Beslan, the school in Georgia that Al-Qaeda took over.
I can't say that I know enough about it to give you an intelligent comment on it, so I won't give you a comment.
All right.
All right?
Worth looking up.
The woman in the black?
Probably is, but I don't purport to know everything. That one's not one I can give you a reasonable response on. So. This is something you want to encourage your professors to do from time to time? Repeat after me. I don't know. It happens.
You know, all around the world, oppressive governments are not allowing indigenous people to speak the truth, and the oppressive governments are rewriting history. For instance, Turkey has tried to deny the Armenian genocide, and the United States and Israel are also denying the Armenian genocide. And so I know that Turkey puts people in prison for even mentioning it. I myself, as an Armenian activist, have suffered lack of freedom of speech. So is there any indigenous organization that helps indigenous people with freedom of speech against tyrannical governments that are going to kill you or oppress you?
I suspect there's several that go basically in a cluster around the working group on indigenous populations, the United Nations. The organizations would be tied in there. There's NGOs that could probably help with you, and usually, not always, but usually they're regionally focused, and I think there's one that focuses on Kurdistan, and that would be fairly proximate. So regionally speaking, you could get the right focus working through them. There are several that are incipient. There's an Indigenous Scholars Association that's just coming into being and so forth. But in terms of any actual state apparatus, if that's what you're looking for, so that you had capability of an enforcement dimension to this, I'm not aware of any. In fact, the Armenian example is real useful
in certain respects in illustrating something. There is a formal compact between the State of Israel and Turkey, okay, that Israel will not allow it to be taught in its schools that what happened in Armenia at the hands of the Turks in 1915, 16, 17, right? Qualified as genocide. There's no Israeli school child that will hear that. The quid pro quo is the official position of the Turkish government that there has only been one genocide in history, and that happened to the Jews. Okay? You don't have that between the United States and Turkey, not in an official way. You have it in a de facto way, and you have essentially an orthodox interpretation of reality that leads you to this position. But the way that works is if you adopt the legitimacy of the position that history has seen one true genocide, then nobody else ever committed it. Well, you get what Edward Alexander calls moral capital accumulating to those who were on the receiving end of the one true. Okay? And you get exoneration for everybody else. So the official position is always that what happened to the Jews at the hands of the Nazis was unique. And of course it was. Every genocide is unique. It has its unique characteristics, undoubtedly. But that does not provide this sort of mantle of exclusivity that all of the governments are collaborating in to one or another extent. By the time it's done, there was no Armenian genocide. It was an auto genocide in Kampuchea. There was no real genocide of American Indians. There was no genocide of the Hereros, because after all, they fought back. There was no genocide of the Tasmanians. There was no genocide of the Beothuks. There was not even to the Gypsies, who were subject to the same decrees as the Jews and sent to the same camps and died in proportionately, perhaps even greater numbers. One people, one time, one place, and if you don't have a guy with a funny little mustache and people with Sam Brown belts and brown shirts doing a goose step down the street, you don't really have genocide. But by God, let's all get out together and hold up candles in memoriam and prevent the guy with the Hitler mustache and the brown shirts from doing what they did all over again. Don't worry, they never will. They'll do it the way they're going to do it, where and when they do it next. We need to understand the phenomena for what it is. Call it by its right name. Call the perpetrators, which includes those who are complicit and those who apologize and try to mask the reality. That's a complicity in its form. For what they are. And for those who would deny the Armenian genocide, I got a word for you. Holocaust denier. Okay, it's not one whit better than the neo-Nazis that denied that what happened to the Jews happened to the Jews. They are reviled, rightly so. They are repugnant, despicable distorters of historical truth, and those who would deny anybody else's genocide are in the same boat. No better, no worse.
All right, thank you very much. That's going to conclude our question and answer session. If you could please take a moment to pause and discuss it.